Welcome to the What Dreamers Do podcast. I'm your host, Carla Gover, an Appalachian musician, flatfoot dancer, mama, creative, and dreamer from Kentucky. I'm on a mission to inspire others to realize their dreams and live their most creative lives. Grab you a mason jar full of sweet tea or something a little stronger and pull up a chair, because it's time to get your dream on. Who's been following you? Because that's what dreamers do. Hello there. I am so excited to be bringing you this conversation with musician, dancer, cultural educator, flute maker, and master of many more marvelous arts, Mr. Matthew Allwell. In this conversation, it really goes deep about the history of American dance, specifically Appalachian flatfooting and clogging, our responsibility as educators to help paint a more complete picture of the evolution of this dance style in the United States, and especially when that comes to the contributions and influences of Black artists on American dance and music. We also talk about the relationship of dancing with the music, our philosophy of improvisation, and how we approach cultivating more diversity in the folk and traditional music worlds of the United States in particular. So again, I'm really thrilled about this conversation. I think you're going to enjoy it. So let's just dive in. All right. Welcome, Dreamers, to another episode of What Dreamers Do. And I'm so happy to be sitting here today with my old buddy, Mr. Matthew Allwell, whom I met when we were both dancing together in a group called Footwork. So thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
I've been really excited to talk to you, and I know we've gone back and forth a whole bunch of times to make this happen. So really appreciate your perseverance in all of the crazy things that you've got going on in your life, making time for us today. We have a listenership that is very interested in creative people, creative minds, people that use their art to try and make a positive change in the world. And I know you fit all of those things. So I think we would love to just kind of hear a little bit about you, you know, just elevator introduction.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So before we met long ago in the 90-aughts, I grew up going to a lot of music and dance festivals. My father is a flute maker, and I'm actually apprenticing with him and my brother. Allwell Flutes is the name of the outfit, and I'm learning to make the transverse wooden flutes that are popularly played in Irish traditional music. So I'm sort of engaging in a long apprenticeship beginning a few years ago with my dad and my brother. And that flute business took us to the Augusta Heritage Center from the time that I was quite young. I think my brother was probably one and I was four or something the first time that we went. And we went every year for the Irish Music Week at Augusta. And then later, when I got into dancing and started learning to do social dancing and clogging, we went for the Dance Week and the Old Time Music Week that they had every summer. So that would have been the place where I met some of my first teachers, Donnie Golden, an Irish step dance teacher from Brooklyn, New York, and Eileen Carson Schatz, who we danced together with. Her troupe at the time was called the Fiddle Puppet Dancers and later became Footwork's Percussive Dance Ensemble. So Augusta was pretty formative in my early years as a dancer, as a musician, just as someone who was being exposed to all of this different music and dance, many different styles and forms and people coming from all over the country and all over the world to this little town in the middle of West Virginia that was kind of a magnet for different folk styles and that sort of thing. So I guess that was probably one of the biggest influences on me in terms of just meeting people in the scene and getting to know the music, starting to learn to dance, all that kind of stuff. And then I apprenticed with Footworks while I was still in high school, went on to dance with them full time for almost 9 years, and then kind of embarked after that on a freelance solo career as a dancer and musician doing all kinds of stuff. I've played in a few bands and danced in a few different groups, kind of circled back around to different styles of percussive dance, wound up kind of taking a deep dive into the tap dance world starting in 2009. and studied for a long time with some folks in Washington, D.C., Bakari Wilder being one of my teachers, who teaches at a studio in Silver Spring called Knock on Wood, which is one of the only all tap dance studios that I know of. So if any of your listeners are in Washington, D.C., I would definitely recommend Knock on Wood as a great resource for tap dance and for percussive dance in general. But yeah, I mean, just kind of a long winding path of studying Irish music, Appalachian music, and flatfooting, tap dancing. I went back to school as an adult, got an undergraduate degree in multimedia performance, and then a graduate studies degree, an MFA in dance, the MFA from Temple University, and actually did my undergrad at Dave's Melkins, where Augusta has been housed for many years. So that same college town in West Virginia has been this funny kind of epicenter that I have circled back around to over the years. And these days I do probably more flute playing and Irish music, but I still do some dance teaching stuff as well, mostly tap dance and flat footing. And, you know, I like to nerd out about folk dance and music and study the history and look at the cultural context and sort of pull on some loose threads that connect to some of the history. And a lot of it is confusing, and there are often more questions than answers. I find.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I have so many questions and so many things I would ask you about after your introduction. It's clear that you have just been pretty much immersed in creativity your whole life, both from, you know, making things, you know, with your family business of flute making, making things with your hands, the music, the dance, the whole community. You know, it's all, they're not all separated out. They all kind of go in a ball, as we know. But one question, this is just sort of random. Was the place that you grew up pretty close to Davis Nelkins, or did you have to drive a ways to get there? I didn't know exactly where you were from.
Right. So I grew up in Nellie's Ford, Virginia, which is actually where I'm speaking to you from right now.
Okay.
Life keeps bringing me back here, and I think I'm probably here for the long haul. My family and I live in Stanton, which is nearby, and the flute shop is based here in Nellie's Ford. We're about 3 hours from Elkins, West Virginia, where the Augusta Heritage Center is located. So not a long drive as drives go, but up and over some significant mountains, which always felt like a kind of an exciting journey. I can remember being real little and looking out the window of the car and watching the mountains roll by. And, you know, Highland County, Virginia kind of gives way to that first bit of West Virginia. And you really feel like you're going into a different place. The geography and the trees and the plants are so different. And the sort of feel of the mountains is very different from what we have here. So I always enjoyed the transition from the western part of Virginia to West Virginia proper.
So one thing that I wanted to ask you, particularly because there are many subjects that I feel that we could talk about and a lot of things that I relate to you about, but would you say that you are a musician who became a dancer, or a dancer who became a musician, or did it just kind of all evolve together?
Oh, it's such a good question. So I guess the short answer is that I played music first. I started learning to play penny whistle and recorder and flute and bowron, Irish frame drum, when I was probably 9 or 10 years old. But the longer answer is that at this point in my life as a dancer and as a musician, I don't necessarily see them as being different things. To me, they're really expressions of the same kind of impulse. And I connect with other people, I think, in similar ways, or I try to when I'm dancing and playing music. So I guess I tend to think of dancing more the way a musician thinks about percussion, and not so much the way a dancer might think about, oh, steps. I'm going to do this step, and then I'm going to do that step, and then I'm going to put these steps together in this way to sort of craft something that is dance, right? So for me, if I'm, you know, and oftentimes if I'm dancing in a jam or in a performance, it's live music and it's right there with the musician. And so the thing that I'm trying to do is establish a real connection with the person who's playing the instrument. And so what I tend to do dance-wise is fairly simple and in a way almost kind of repetitive, because I played percussion before I learned to dance. So I think I tend to kind of approach the dancing like a percussionist, which is I want to lay down a really solid, stable, simple groove so that the melody has something to kind of sit on and lock into. And once that connectivity is established, then I feel like, you know, maybe I can branch out a little bit and do something that's, you know, maybe more interesting from a dance perspective, but really just keep bringing it back around to this dead simple groove. You know, the fiddle or the, whatever instrument is gonna play that melody, and I'm just gonna try to lock into it. Da ticka da ticka da ticka da ticka da ticka da. And any other communication that might happen between me and that musician, for me, kind of has to be predicated on, have we found a stable groove together? And so in that way, I think it's not necessarily dance versus music. It's sound and it's connection and it's communication. And so looking to kind of approach it from that way. Now, I will say that the thing that is confusing to me at this point in my dance life is that dance tends to really draw focus in a social setting. So at a jam or at a concert, you know, you can be sitting there playing music and people are enjoying it and they're listening to the music and they're watching. But as soon as somebody starts dancing, the energy tends to kind of laser focus in on what the dancer is doing. Sometimes that's great. And I feel like it's celebratory and it's joyful and it's wonderful, but it can pull focus away from the connection between the dancer and the musician. So oftentimes in a performance setting, I am looking to try to create a performance environment that really supports a shared space, not this person is playing and I'm going to get up and dance. So, and that can be anything from how you stage it. You know, a lot of times I go to see a dance and music show and the dancers will be out in front of the musicians with their backs to them, downstage of the musicians, so that they really are the thing that the audience sees. And that's fine. It's great. It's not a problem. There are times when it's appropriate, but for me, that really undermines my ability to connect with the other instrumentalists. If I can't see them, if they're behind me, that's just one example. But if I was going to set up a stage set in a way that was more intentional, I would want us both to be equally downstage, upstage, and turned in towards each other, at least enough that we're kind of on a diagonal so that we can really see and hear and lock in and make eye contact and pay attention to each other. And so, you know, small things like that, that are just about creating a particular type of a shared space.
I love it. I love to hear you articulate that. And I feel that maybe it's a matter of convergent evolution, or maybe it's because I also played music before I danced, but I have come to feel the same way about, especially, you know, because I do a little bit of the other styles, but not to the extent that you do. You know, you have a deep dive in Irish dance and tap dance and the things that I've only dabbled in. So I'm really coming at it from that traditional Appalachian music perspective, but it really is all about that conversation between the musician and the dancer. And, you know, I know that we could do a whole episode on what the perceived differences are between, you know, and I'm using really heavy air quotes for these words, flat footing and clogging, because it seems like people want to really separate those styles out now in a way that sure. I never grew up thinking about them being separate. But if there is a separation, if I'm going to think about, you know, like a philosophical approach of flat footing and a philosophical approach of clogging, flat footing has come to mean to me, one of the things it means is you're in a musical conversation and you're probably at a jam session and it's probably live music. Whereas clogging can be really broad. It could be, you know, recorded music, and it's definitely has a tendency, I think, to be more about the movements and look at what my legs are doing and look at what my skirt's doing. And it could be any style of music, you know, it could be, you know, pop country, it could be hip hop or anything with contemporary clogging. And so that doesn't emphasize that connection between the dancer and the musician in the way that you're talking about, and in the way that I really appreciate highlighting myself. And just to add to what you're saying, another thing that I think has influenced certainly my dance teaching, if not my practice, is the fact that I went back to school in as well and got a master's degree in teaching language. And I only use it teaching dance now. I don't actually do anything like in the public schools, but not only did I see so many similarities in the learning, the pedagogy of teaching language to what I'd been learning from actual, you know, actually teaching dance for a couple decades, but I learned probably more things that I could fold back into dance teaching through learning the best practices of how we learn languages and how we use language to communicate, and that especially the ways that you can teach language vocabulary in a way that's sheltered and helps people not be overwhelmed with all of the vocabulary lists. Instead, you know, you emphasize smaller groups of steps, and kind of like you started your explanation with laying down the groove first. It reminds me of how Mark Schatz used to say about bass playing. And I know, you know, you spent even more time with Mark than I have, but he would say the first rule is do no harm about bass playing. And I totally feel that way about flat footing, because if the groove's not there, I don't care what kind of flashy step you're doing.
Sure.
It's not there for me.
Yeah. I feel like that do no harm idea is a good starting place for flat footers, cloggers, baron players, people to play the spoons and the bones. Like, there's all of these rhythmic expressions that are kind of adjacent to old time music and Irish music. And when they're quote unquote good, they can really uplift the music and be magical. And when they're off time or they're not connected to the music, they can wreck a jam. And
they really can
in four bars of music. You know what I mean? So I'm always kind of harping on my students to say, and I don't teach as much as I used to these days, but when I was teaching more, I would say, you know, you show up at a jam, A, you might want to leave your tap shoes behind and wear some leather soled shoes, just because
absolutely,
sonically you'll be able to blend better.
But
even more than that, like, pay attention to what's happening when you walk in. Like, is it a small intimate affair with just two people? Is it a bigger jam where there's a little bit more of a chaos factor, so it's easier to just kind of do your thing and not draw too much energy out of the room? But yeah, just approaching it with some humility and saying, like, it's really not about me and what steps I want to do. It's about making a connection with the other people in the room.
It reminds me, my buddy used to have this button that she would wear to jam sessions that said, egg shaker is a privilege, not a right. But the same could be said, like, of any, like you're saying, of any percussive element that you're adding to a jam.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and really, as musicians, even if you're playing a guitar or a fiddle, you know, listening and being sensitive and being aware and respectful, that's part of it.
I think you're absolutely right. I think, yeah, just having that awareness of, you know, some basic kind of ground rules and respectful communication with the people that you're playing music or dancing with is key.
Well, the Stanley Brothers advertised for Martha White Flower, so I'm going to do a sort of cooking advertisement here to support this podcast. I have a confession to make. I love to cook from scratch, but many nights these days, I'm only cooking for my son and myself. When I'm busy and tired, sometimes it's a little bit too easy to get takeout, so I decided to try some of those meal kit boxes that I saw advertised, and I went through four different ones until I found the one that I like best, Home Chef. Every week, I get to pick four meals that I think my family would like, and they send the ingredients right to my door. This isn't processed food either. It's just healthy meats, fresh vegetables, and grains that I prepare. It usually takes me 30 minutes or less to get supper on the table, and my picky son loves every meal. Plus, it's way cheaper than takeout. If you want to try it out, just go to carlagover.com/supper. I don't get paid for this endorsement. I just truly like the product. And if you sign up using my link, they will send me credits toward my own boxes. And with an almost 13-year-old boy in the house, I could use them. Plus, all that good food is going to help me keep recording this podcast for you. Just do me a favor and don't tell Granny. I know that with your family's background in Irish music and the amount of time that you have spent learning about Irish dance, you are probably more aware than most dancers that are flat-footers and cloggers of some of the connections and some of the links that the dance styles of Appalachia have with Irish dance. At the same time, I would be interested in hearing about those connections that you may have noticed just from doing both styles so fluently, but also maybe some of the elements that you might see crop up in Appalachian dance that aren't in Irish dance, and particularly speaking to other cultural influences that we might have in Appalachian dance. I talk a lot about how Appalachian history has been whitewashed, and I know that's something that you have thought a great deal about as well. But I'm bringing this up because a lot of times when I post something on, you know, YouTube, when I post some dance, or when I post something on Facebook or Instagram, any of the social media platforms, there's always somebody that gets in the comment and authoritatively says, yes, this is straight from Ireland. And they're like, sometimes they're even like trying to educate me, like, yes, your people's dance came from Scotland and Ireland. And isn't that cool? It's basically just Irish dance. And I'm thinking, not really. It's really not.
Yeah.
So I'd love to hear what you have to say about that.
Yeah, boy.
It's a big subject, I know.
It's a big subject. You got to love the comment threads. Like, I was recently watching a video of some step dancers from the Ottawa Valley that had been posted by RTE, an Irish media outlet. Mm-hmm. And there was this long string of, I don't know, it had kind of blown up and gone viral. So there were more comments than could ever facilitate a healthy discussion. And mm-hmm. so, you know, at a certain point in that environment, you just have to be like, hands up, whatever, you know, people are going to have all kinds of micro conversations and take away whatever they're going to take away. But there were all these people saying, oh, this is Irish dancing, or, oh, this is clogging. Oh, this is tap dancing, you know, and then there were people from Ottawa saying, no, this is Ottawa Valley step dancing. Like, we have our own style and it's similar and it's historically related and there are connections, but it's also its own form of dance. Similarly, I mean, like what you described, I have got into some arguments that were probably much longer than they needed to be with people online who want to claim Appalachian flat footing, not just for Ireland, but for England, and who are convinced that it's all just English clogging. To me, those sort of reductive versions of any form of dance are really frustrating, because I think that in the United States, Appalachian flatfooting and clogging, tap dance, and other styles of percussive dance that are American are complicated, and they are not linear straight descendants from any one form of dance. They're not mm-hmm. Scottish. They're not Irish. They're not English. They are the result of a gradual process of amalgamation and hybridization and communication that took place over hundreds of years, not just in the United States, but in the Caribbean. And dances of the African diaspora, dance and music from the African diaspora, are at least as important, and many, myself included, would argue for maybe more important than some of the quote unquote white traditions. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I would agree with you. Appalachian dance, like old time music, has been very whitewashed, as it has been branded as being Appalachian. And, you know, I'm not here to take that identity away from anyone, but those dance forms, for one thing, they were all over the United States. The antecedents of Appalachian flatfooting and clogging, I believe, are the same antecedents of tap dance, which are the jig and clog dances that were popular both on stage and off stage throughout the mid 19th century. On stage, from the 1840s all the way through the end of the 1800s, they would have been done in minstrel shows in blackface, often by white people, but not always by white people. There were black performers who wore blackface as well. And it's a pretty complicated history, I think, because those dances were so commodified and they were so profitable. Mm-hmm. They were a huge cultural export that made money in the forms of the stage shows, in the forms of bound sheet music publications, dance manuals, banjos, all of this sort of material culture that profited pretty heavily from the black experience and from the African diaspora and from dance and music that came pretty directly from various parts of Africa. You know, I'm not a banjo scholar, but I've hung out with a lot of banjo scholars who talk about those connections. And in some ways, I think the banjo community has reckoned a little bit more heavily with that history and is trying to unpack it and figure out what it means. The tap dance community never really left. Like, tap didn't get to be whitewashed the way that Appalachian dance did, because there have been so many notable Black performers all along, and especially since the 1970s in the sort of tap revival period. Many of the sort of cultural leaders of that art form are Black. So I think that puts a bit of a different spin on it. But there are plenty of people who are my mentors in the tap scene who are quick to critique these sort of whitewashed narratives, even of tap dance, you know, where you say mm-hmm. tap dance and people think of Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly,
yeah,
Ginger Rogers, Eleanor Powell, you know, those would be like these instant sort of visual touchstones for people who grew up watching movie musicals. And I think there's a good sort of a counter argument that says, hey, there is a pantheon of Black dancers who didn't have the same access to markets, capital, resources, and audiences the way that their white counterparts did. So, you know, even after spending a long time sort of thinking about this stuff and looking at the history and trying to unpack it in my own work in school, you know, I don't have any answers to those questions. Some of that history is real heavy. I'm not the person who's best qualified to speak about it or take the front seat in that narrative. And we got a lot of work to do, you know. The communities that I hang out in are, you know, the sort of trad dance and music communities that surround square dancing and contra dancing, flat footing and clogging, Irish music. In some ways, they are fairly progressive, and in some ways, they pay a lot of lip service to being more integrated or having sort of a socially progressive agenda. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, I feel like it's lip service, and they're not ready to like take that next step and be a little bit uncomfortable and engage more directly with the kind of philosophies that are more apparent in the Black Lives Matter movement and in some of the conversations around banjo music. So mm-hmm. I think we're at kind of an interesting moment historically and culturally, because there's a lot of information out there and people are getting hip to some of the difficult parts of the history and they're starting to reckon with it. And a lot of us are like, well, what do we do with this? Like, what's the next step? Clearly, we're not done with the sort of like civil rights agenda attempts to deal with the legacy of slavery and the sort of racist institutions that are still underpinning so many of our cultural institutions.
It's true. It is not a comfortable space. It is not a comfortable set of emotions. It is not comfortable work to do to engage in the kinds of social change that we need to engage in to create a just world for at least a just United States. You know, that's where I am. So that's what I'm working on. And I think that one reason the arts are such a powerful space to begin to do that are because you can, at least in these art forms that we're talking about, you can really, even if you just start to scratch the surface a little bit, you can see how many different cross-cultural relationships, scenes, scenarios, parts of history, moments, institutions came together to create what we now have in, as many of our American folk music and dance traditions. And for me, one of the ways that this comes up in my work is that I'm involved in this bilingual theater company called Cornbread and Tortillas. And we have a piece that's kind of a journey through different parts of North and South America. And it deals with immigration and with immigrants and with people, you know, who've come to Kentucky somewhat recently. And I think it's important to, as part of creating a space that is more welcoming for the immigrants that are arriving here right now, to acknowledge the fact that we are all immigrants. And not that long ago, many of our families were immigrants to, you know, to Kentucky, to the United States, to other parts of Appalachia. And so, again, we're using the arts to sort of engage these difficult conversations and these things that maybe aren't talked about enough. And in some ways, it's kind of like archaeology, because as you said, there's no pat, simple black and white answer to what is the history of Appalachian flatfooting? It's XYZ. We can speculate, we can guess, we can study, we can read and gain insights, I think. But a lot of times it's like, I suspect that this dance step might have been influenced by this group. And this one seems like it probably was influenced by this other group. And it just feels a lot like some sort of excavation process. And it's not always comfortable when you raise these issues, depending on the space you're in. It's certainly not comfortable for those of us who might be putting ourselves in the position of getting pushback, but it's especially uncomfortable for the people whose skin color causes them to be in a really marginalized population in the United States. And so that's, I guess that's why we're trying to do this work.
I got to a certain point in my sort of dance study and dance life where I felt like I had been in some spaces where merely by getting up on stage as a white person and performing these dance traditions in a way that was not contextualized for the audience and doing happy clogging, you know, or getting up and like, I'm going to flat foot to a banjo tune and it's going to be fun and everybody's happy. I felt a deep sort of a discomfort that there was an opportunity there that was being missed. And that I was really in danger of, if not reifying some of those stereotypes and problems, certainly not combating them or changing them. And so at that point, I got a lot more interested in trying to make sure that I was giving students and audiences some information and raising some questions alongside the sort of fun, joyful, hey, we're having a cultural moment. Experience to
so
say
what would that look like? What would that, sorry to interrupt,
so it would look like when I taught flatfooting and clogging as a young dancer, it was usually just teaching technique. This is the technique. It's from Appalachia. You know, its roots are in African and Irish music and dance. Hey, presto, isn't the American melting pot great? Let's do some flatfooting. Not a lot of historical or cultural context and not a lot of invitation to the students to say, here is some of the history that is uncomfortable. Here's how I feel about that. And I invite you to think about it and engage with it in or out of class. And I've had everything from really productive discussions with students who are hungry for more information and really want to think about it to students who are like, why are you messing with my buzz? I just want to have a fun time. Mm-hmm. Keep your politics out of my folk music. Mm-hmm. I'm here to have fun. I don't want to have to think about anything hard. And, you know, I got to a point where I was like, yeah, you need to learn from someone else. Cause like, I'm not interested in providing a space that doesn't challenge you or ask you any hard questions. Like there are plenty of places where you can go do that. And so, you know, just presenting students with kind of more information, more resources, you know, showing, like I didn't used to show very much video footage in class. Mm-hmm. And now I almost never teach a class without showing some historical film footage and talking about it. It sometimes means that we do less dancing in class. Mm-hmm. And there are students who are a little frustrated by that if they think they're going to show up and sweat hard for an hour and get their workout in. And I'm like, well, that's fine. There are plenty of classes where you can get that. I want to look at some of this film footage and talk about, you know, some of these questions that arise. If we look at that sort of early period where what was often called hillbilly music in its early stage eventually came to be called country/old-time music, there's this gradual progression there where initially it's the record labels who are making decisions about what is blues and what is old time and creating mm-hmm. separate record catalogs. And one of them is white and it's for a white audience. And one of them is black and it's for a black audience. And I think that's the sort of beginning of that moment where these things bifurcate and suddenly old time and bluegrass and country music are seen as being white and blues and jazz music are black. And mm-hmm. I don't think that really reflects the history adequately. And I think the same thing happened to the dance, mm-hmm. which is why so many of our associations with tap dance are about jazz music and they're about the Black experience. But we think of clogging as being really white, which historically it wasn't. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But once that expectation is in place and we have segregation happening already, then those spaces become really white. And then the dance is a white dance form, at least in the sense that many of the spaces that it's happening in are white spaces designed for white people.
And that's where we are in a lot of, you know, like you, I have also traveled all over different parts of the world, but especially in the United States. You go to a town, you go to the old time where you're playing for the folk society. A lot of times it's super homogenous and super white. And for me, as someone who is involved in on the programming end now, you know, I'm the artistic director for our Mountain Music School. Our biggest challenge right now is trying to acknowledge, okay, these spaces, for whatever reason, not necessarily through malicious intent, these kinds of spaces throughout the United States have not been places where people of color can feel like they're welcome or comfortable. So we want to change that. You know, we want to make a more welcoming and inclusive environment. We want to invite more staff who are people of color. And at the same time, the challenge there is the cultural traditions have been separated for a long time. And so when we're simultaneously looking for qualified people who are also experts in our camp in particular is focused on Kentucky repertoire, mm-hmm. you know, it's difficult to find. So like we're kind of just starting with the intention of trying to create a more inclusive space and then hopefully gradually make our teaching roster more diverse. But it is, mm-hmm. there's a lot of different levels of challenging things about that.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been in some similar spaces that are doing similar things. My partner and spouse, Emily Olson, pioneered the first American vernacular social dance curriculum at a college, at Davis and Elkins College in West Virginia. And she took the reins of what had been Dance Week at Augusta and eventually became American Vernacular Dance Week. And as someone who was sort of adjacent and teaching and was part of the design of the curriculum, I witnessed a real range of reactions from within the community, within the sort of larger folk music community, to that shift and that change. You know, there's people who've been coming to these events for their entire lives, and they don't want it to change. They just want it to be the thing that it's always been, and they want it to mean the thing that it has always meant to them, which is understandable, right? Mm-hmm. But it is not necessarily compatible with a shift in what that community is for, who's going to be there, and what's going to happen. I've been in some conversations with folks on programming committees for, you know, for lack of a more comprehensive word, folk dance and music. Mm-hmm. And they will have these sort of very rigid notions about what traditional means or what folk means. Mm-hmm. And those include things like, all of the music has to be live. All of the instruments have to be acoustic instruments, right? In order for it to meet their conception of what folk is or what traditional music is. And it's, you know, I have been in some situations where I have tried to push back against that a little bit and say, there are a bunch of dance forms that in their current cultural idiomatic expression don't use live music for various complicated reasons, but by excluding them from your paradigm of what traditional means, spoiler alert, you're excluding a bunch of dance and music that is more directly connected to Black culture and people of color more generally. And so, I mean, that's just one example, but I think if we want to make spaces that are different, we're going to have to loosen the reins a little bit about what those spaces are, what they're for, what tradition means. You know, again, this is not something I have an answer for. I'm not currently programming any events, but I am sort of looking ahead and thinking ahead to try to imagine what does that look like and how do we make something that has a bit more of an explicit mission statement. It's not just about preserving folk traditions, but it's about change.
That's such an excellent point because, I mean, I love traditional Kentucky old time repertoire and I'm going to be involved in perpetuating it and preserving it. But at one point, you know, I was having a discussion with some of the people I work with and they were like, well, how can we get more Black students interested in playing old time Kentucky fiddle tunes? And I'm thinking, I have no problem with that as a concept, but at the same time, if we're really just scholars and aficionados of what is in the folk process, in the vernacular, when do you just look around and see what people are actually doing and appreciate it and like try to embrace and enfold that or perpetuate it or support it or whatever? And when do you just try to like bang on this one drum of like, oh, everybody needs to play this style of music. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that what you just touched on to me is really key, right? There are a bunch of instances I can think of in my own life where the people who are publicizing these events and programming them, they genuinely want the space to be more diverse. But there's this tacit assumption that what that means is that these other people are going to come into our space and do the thing that we like to do.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's the mistake is yeah. to say this event is about square dancing and we want to make it more diverse so that we can have a more diverse square dance.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of saying, let's loosen the reins a little bit. Maybe it doesn't look like a square dance. Maybe it involves square dancing, but it also involves a turntable and an MC and people doing house dancing. Right. And that like in creating a space that is more of an organic conversation between cultural paradigms, maybe we make something different.
Yeah. Because we have to presume that that's how all of this stuff that we're trying to perpetuate and preserve evolved in the first place. Right. That's
exactly
the irony of it. And I will say just, I did attend, you know, to the listeners, but also I'll say it to you. I got to attend for the last year, I guess. I don't know how many years you did it, of the American Vernacular Dance Week. And it was just brilliant. It was my favorite week-long music and dance camp event I've ever been to. I was just in heaven the whole time. I loved all the different people that I got a chance to learn from. I mean, it really touched me as a dancer, as an educator. And I know we're kind of running out of time, so this might be a good moment to bring it all back home and tell people if they want to actually come and learn from you and your partner and hang out and have some of these difficult but also good and necessary conversations, where can they do that?
Good question. Yeah. So the American Vernacular Dance Week that you mentioned, which shout out to my spouse and partner, Emily Olson, for sort of spearheading that shift and really, I think, creating an event that was different and really meaningful to a lot of people. She and I have stepped back a bit from teaching. We're not doing any programming or organizing at the moment, but we are doing some teaching. We taught at a couple of summer camps this summer. I've taught quite a bit over the years for camps sponsored by the Country Dance and Song Society, mm-hmm. and two camps in recent years that are sponsored by an organization called the Lloyd Shaw Foundation. So we're teaching at a camp this winter in Western Maryland called Terpsichore, which is a week-long dance and music camp that is sort of designed for families. You don't have to have a family, but if you do have kids and you want to bring them, there's programming sort of broken out by age group, classes during the day, informal gatherings, and dances in the evening. That camp and those communities are largely focused on Anglo traditions, so mm-hmm. English dance and music, and some American styles as well. English country dancing, contra dancing, New England style contra dancing, some square dancing and old time music, and oftentimes I have been there in the capacity of teaching clogging or flat footing. Mm-hmm. They are fairly centered around, you know, Anglo and traditions from the Northeast, mm-hmm. and oftentimes there will be a little bit of some other tradition mixed in there. Okay. They're wonderful weeks and we enjoy teaching at them. They're not necessarily the sort of boundary pushing thing that we just described,
right,
which is no shade on them. They're wonderful communities and wonderful people. And I've had some very meaningful teaching experiences there and artistic experiences there. So we'll be teaching there at Terpsichore this winter. And I imagine we'll be doing some teaching next year at summer camps, although we don't have anything on the books yet. But yeah, I mean, I think there's a real opportunity, and I'm hoping that, you know, the right people will seize that opportunity in this moment as these traditional music and dance communities evolve, to design events that are more specifically geared towards a sense of gatheringness and bringing people into the shared space, and not necessarily myopic about any one tradition or any one folk style. Obviously, you know, if Irish music is your jam or old time banjo is your jam and you want a space that's just kind of carved out for that particular form, that's fine. And people should have that. And I enjoy those events, but I also enjoy, you know, events that are not so specific to any one community and invite people to have a real conversation across lines of genre or form or culture, you know.
Absolutely.
I think,
because when you do that, what I've noticed, and I've been doing more programming, like I said, I've done some programming with Cornbread and Tortillas where we're bringing together communities that have been in Kentucky a little bit longer and then communities that are more recently arrived from Cuba or Mexico. And I've seen so many examples of this where you think you're just making tortillas in the workshop, you know, and then all of a sudden, you know, this woman from Guatemala is describing the grinding poverty she grew up with without the social safety net we have. Or this woman from Mexico is describing how she walked for thousands of miles with her kids just to try to escape the violence. And like these stories that happen or two people sharing about growing up in Eastern Kentucky and growing up in Guatemala and using corn cobs in their grandmother's outhouses, these moments of solidarity. And so for me, what the kinds of gathering that you are describing, where we bring these different perspectives together, where we broaden our ideas about, you know, what fits into our boxes of folk tradition or this or that style, you humanize the political, because ultimately, you know, you mentioned somebody saying, you know, I just keep your politics out of my folk music. These aren't political issues. These are human issues. They're justice and human rights issues of just having a world where all of our dominant systems aren't hetero patriarchal, you know, white supremacist, basically. I don't know, maybe not everybody agrees with that, but these are the kinds of ways that the arts can really help and that artists like you can help. We help create the space to have these conversations, and the conversations are what take it from the realm of the political to the personal, which is where the change I think needs to happen, rather than just these black and white ideological arguments where we're shouting each other on Facebook and red states and blue states. It's like at the personal level.
Yeah. And like, I don't know, it, you know, I have dark moments where it seems like a mess that's going to get better before it gets worse. But if there is any, you know, light at the end of the tunnel or hope that I see, it doesn't happen online, right? It happens, like you're saying, it happens in the kitchen while you're making food together. It happens when you sit down with somebody who has a different musical paradigm and you say, well, let's see if we can play together and figure out what that means. Or you go to a dance in someone else's community and maybe you feel a bit uncomfortable because suddenly now you're the one who's a fish out of water, and learning to sit in those places of both discomfort and meeting and sort of coming to someone else and sharing a moment together in real time, face to face. I mean, to me, those are the things that seem like the only hope we have of productive conversation that digs our way out of this mess.
Well, I guess we're just going to keep playing tunes and dancing and trying to bit by bit, you know, make a difference in the world. But I do so appreciate you taking the time to sit and have this conversation with me. I'm going to put the link to your website or social handles that you would like to share with people. So if they want to send you a message or just catch up with what you're doing.
Sure. I am Matt Allwell on most of the social media platforms, MattAllwell. I also have a website where you can send me an email through the contact page, mattallwell.com. If you want to check out the flute shop where I'm an apprentice, it's Allwell Flutes. So allwellflutes.com is that website. And maybe what I'll also do, Carla, is I'll send you some links to organizations and individuals that I think are kind of on the leading edge of some of the change that we have been talking about. There's some groups that we've worked with or collaborated with over the years, some folks that I've learned from, some of my teachers, just, you know, if there's a place in the, like you said, in the web notes, resources where people can go if they want to kind of get another perspective on some of the stuff that we've been talking about.
Well, that sounds great. Appreciate you, appreciate the work you do, and I hope we get the chance to dance together live in person sooner.
Absolutely.
Or later.
Yeah, me too. Thanks for the invite. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Cheers.
Well, I couldn't leave you guys without playing a little sample from one of Matthew's albums. The tune you're listening to is called Stormness Head / The Friendly Cephalophore. I had to go look up what that means. You can go look it up too. It's kind of confusing. But that is from the album Cybertrad, and I recommend that you go check out Matthew's music and dance on the social media platforms. If you follow him, you're guaranteed to see some interesting music and dance content and also learn more about pickles and fermented foods and see quite a few gratuitous cat pictures. So anyway, hope you enjoy this music and we will see you next time on What Dreamers Do. This episode of What Dreamers Do is sponsored by the online Appalachian Flatfooting and Clogging Academy, the only course of its kind and the most comprehensive step-by-step program available for dancers learning this style. I teach beginning and intermediate students the steps and skills they need to dance to traditional mountain music so that they can be confident, joyful dancers and improvisers. Unlike others who just teach the same handful of steps or who just teach routines, I give you not only a bountiful library of steps, but a framework for understanding how the steps fit together with the music. Learn more about the Academy and get started for free with my video tutorial, The 3 Essential Steps for Appalachian Flatfooting and Clogging. Visit www.carlagover.com today. It's a holy fight.